Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. This is Joe Hagan here. I'm here with my co-host, Emily Jane Fox. Hello, Emily.
Hi, Joe. Happy to have you back this week.
I am happy to be back. We have had, it's a long, hot summer. It's the dog days of summer, and the dogs, in this case, are the, not the good kind. They're the ones barking at you from the news and making you sweat even more than you're already sweating. But occasionally good news comes over the transom like it has today. Or
bring it to us.
We just found out that the Attorney General of New York has uncovered what she alleges is fraud in the NRA and has moved to dissolve the entire organization, which seems like a radical and amazing development, considering, and a politically significant one, considering they have been one of the most important funders of the GOP and, a massive arm of propaganda in this time of concern for gun violence, which we don't have to review because it's so obvious to all. But anyway, this is certainly going to be a huge narrative in this election now. I feel like this is going to introduce a whole new level of much needed debate in this coming election cycle. So there's that.
You know what's interesting about what you just said? A lot of it is interesting. I always find it interesting. But it makes me long for a post-election period, particularly if Joe Biden is president, when we can actually debate things like this, when we can have substantive policy change. So over the last 4 years, we haven't had any kind of substantive policy change. It's just been one fire after the other that's had to be put out. And we haven't really had the time and the chance and the ability to focus on gun violence, which is essential, on really coming to debate what healthcare should look like in society, debates over education, all the things that are normal political discourse we haven't been able to even have a conversation about because things have been so chaotic.
You could hardly argue that this has been the most anti-intellectual period of our adult lives in the national discourse. I mean, basically, when there's a chance to talk about it, as when there were these horrible murders in a club in Florida, you know, the president basically says more outrageous things in response to it, doesn't respond to it, changes the subject, makes it about him, and then we move on somehow in this kind of unbelievable way. It's like, how could you not take this opportunity to – I mean, that's what you're supposed to do if you're a leader. And now we know that we're not dealing with a leader, and that's, what this election is all about and why it's so important.
The other thing is – we're so engulfed in putting out this pandemic fire, as we should be. That should really be the only conversation that we're having right now, and it really is the only conversation we're having right now. And this announcement this morning from the Attorney General of New York is an important one, and I'm sure it will get drowned out and forgotten about in no time because we're dealing with so much other stuff that it feels more pressing. But I think the possibility that we will have a leader who can actually get this under control, then allowing for a conversation about gun control and all sorts of other incredibly important issues. I wonder, though, is this going to ignite a culture war that will help President Trump?
Well, I worried about that, and I have worried about that. But and it's just the kind of thing that he would and is likely to do, right?
He's longing for that. That's why I think that the protests when people were using the phrase defund the police was going to be good for him. I think that the conversation evolved and the pandemic got worse. And so those conversations have sadly faded from our constant drum as they once were. But, you know, that was going to be a real talking point for him. I think he would much rather focus on something like the NRA or police reform than a pandemic.
If he does that, he will not. I think that, you know, making an argument for guns, the Second Amendment and the NRA is not going to win him new voters. I feel like it's just going to underline what's already there, and it's not going to be a big appeal to women voters. You know, if you've ever seen an NRA sticker on a pickup truck in America, the likelihood that there's a woman in the driver seems rather low to me. It is really about the kind of, like, you know, white men and white men anger that this sort of attaches to. Just to go back really quickly to your kind of concept of debate and whether we can have one and even think clearly about anything from day to day, you know, one of the nature of the Trump era, I think, when we will look back, and the nature of fascism is that the attention of the entire country cannot seem to go away from just one subject.
Yeah.
You know, in North Korea, there's just one face everywhere and everybody has to look at it. Well, look like what we're dealing with. He's trying to simulate that through this, making himself the sun, at which everybody has to look and be blinded all day long, right?
Sure.
I mean, that is sort of what we've been dealing with, and just what a relief it will be. And I think it'll be a relief for conservatives. I think it'll be a relief for everybody when they're not having to pay attention every single day to what's going on in the White House and at the national level. I mean, we've heard this, you know, people can't wait to be bored by Joe Biden. You know, they hope he's sleepy because then we'll be able to think about other things, right?
I think that there's a real hunger, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat down the line, whoever it may be, to just have someone who you don't have to constantly be watching and paying attention to. And that boring is okay and stability is okay and chaos is not something that you want to live in and sustain. I think that that's the biggest takeaway from this.
Well, this week I've got Kurt Anderson who I'm interviewed. So Kurt Anderson, he is a novelist and an author and a radio personality, but he's got a new book called Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. It's kind of a sequel to his last book, Fantasyland, which was sort of about how, you know, non-factual information and conspiracies became the norm in American life. And he kind of traces the whole history. This new one is such a important kind of a primer for this election so that people can understand what this election is about beyond our daily headline experience. You know, every day we're paying attention to the latest drama, but we need to pan back. We need to get up to 20,000 feet and see, how did we arrive to this moment where, you know, Trump, who represents the go-go 80s capitalist caricature, right? How did he end up coming back into our lives as saving us from all the problems of capitalism, by selling us on this trade thing, and that he was going to change life for the middle class and the working class? Well, guess what? As this book makes clear, a lot of the problems that we're facing now have to do with the way in which the right and the GOP, starting with Reagan in 1980, re-engineered the economy so that the rich got richer, unions were crushed, there was no more guardrails on Wall Street, and everything that we see before us has happened. And it's a very detailed history, and it's very useful as we go into this election to realize the crossroads that we are at, that we could continue going down this path of demagoguery and decline, or we have to reinvent our society and especially the economy to put a floor under all of these falling prospects of the poor and the working class who have nothing there. The right convinced them that they didn't need it, and that you know, it was going to trickle down. And of course, 2008 taught everybody that something was wrong, but nobody's known what to do about it. We just tried Trump. How's that working out? So this book is really takes you, it's about who architected it, how it was architected, and ways of thinking about how to undo it.
I can't wait to hear.
I want to point out, some of you are going to listen to this and you're going to hear something you've never heard on this podcast or haven't heard for several months, which is crickets, a breeze, a wind blowing. So what does that mean? This is the first podcast interview that I have ever done in person. You know, during this pandemic, we have only done interviews over the phone and, you know, using Zoom and all these technologies. Well, Kurt Anderson happens to live an hour from me. I drove to where he lives. We sat outdoors 6 feet apart and were able to actually conduct the interview in person. It felt like a breakthrough.
What a wonderful thing. Also, how nice is it that it's recorded outside? Feels very summery to me. You know, you missed something. I love getting to talk to you however I can talk to you. We're Zooming as we do this, so I get to see your face. But when you're in person, particularly, we've spent both of our entire careers getting to meet people in person, and you read different cues and you don't have to worry about stepping over each other. It's just much easier to have a normal conversation in person, as we've all experienced over the last couple of months. Doing an interview is really tricky when you're not in person, and if you're not doing interviews, I'm not sure you can totally appreciate what you miss out on. So I'm curious how much better you sound.
Well, let's find out. Let's go to the interview, which took place live and in concert. Here we go. Kurt Anderson, welcome to Inside the Hive. We find ourselves today outdoors and in person. This is the first interview I've ever done for this podcast in which I am in the same room with the person.
Well, and it's the first one I've done, certainly for this book, probably will be the only one, and the first professional experience I've had face-to-face IRL.
Well, I have to say, you and I have some history together, but let's put some full disclosure out right at the top. You used to be my boss, so therefore I'm obligated to you know, throw some hardballs at you to inoculate myself against corruption.
Or at least fake ones, at least softballs that are gussied up to look like hardballs. Yes, definitely.
Right. Okay. Well, with that out there, your last book, Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, was posited that the 60s revolutions, the liberation movements, the birth of the modern individual in American society engendered this revolution that indulged more freely in woo-woo thinking and conspiracy thinking and fact-free beliefs about reality that have led us to this moment where we have a lying reality TV show,
among other things, but yes,
president.
It was a
thread in the book, one that interested me a lot, and so it's brought us to this sort of ludicrous moment. And now you have this new book, Evil Geniuses: The Unmaking of America, A Recent History, which is a perfect sort of partner book to the last one. But it's interesting to me that, you know, the theory of the book in itself posits possibly a conspiracy that, you know, starting in the 1980s and possibly a little bit before, the United States economy was totally reengineered to favor Wall Street and big business and the 1% by this cabal of right-wing economic thinkers and big business interests. And so here we are, you know, indulging in a conspiracy, but this one's real.
Well, no, it's I have had that thought myself. I realized halfway through this book that although these are kind of two volumes, as a friend of mine says, two volumes in your history of the fuckening of America, they are in conversation and one, they are companion volumes. And yet, as you say, a large part of Fantasyland is about the conspiracy mindedness that has always been part of not only the American way of thinking, but of human way of thinking. But got out of, was one of the things that got out of control in and after the 60s. And of course, and I still believe that most conspiracy theories are preposterous. Let's fast forward to now and look at QAnon, for instance.
Right.
But I, writing this book and doing the research and realizing how much of a coordinated, strategic, long game was involved by these rich right-wing people and right-wing activists, zealots, and big business. How it, you know, we can talk about what is defined as a conspiracy, but this one certainly quacks, walks, and looks a lot like one. I mean, again, it was in plain sight. Most of us didn't pay very close attention or put two and two and two and two and two together and to see the whole landscape of change that was being wrought in the 70s and 80s and beyond.
Well, you know, the impulse that people think of as driving the anti-establishment countercultural figures, these guys got together. Let's talk, for instance, about
organized capital.
That's right. And the Powell memo.
Yes.
These people that we didn't know about, you know, I didn't anyway. Yeah. Lewis Powell nominated the Supreme Court, had the, before that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I had heard about the Powell memo some years ago, and among a certain category of journalists and academics and lefties, it has been well known for 20 odd years. It was a revelation to me because just whether or not it was the original scripture and playbook for this long game that the economic right played to take over and re-engineer our system, in retrospect, given the success of that long game along exactly the lines described in 1971 in this 40-page memo, it's an extraordinary forensic artifact. So this guy, Lewis Powell, he was an establishment, democratic, moderate, decorous lawyer of national repute in Virginia, worked for the tobacco companies and all kinds of corporate clients and served on boards, just a, you know, normal establishment figure. He, like so many of people in that milieu and in C-suites and the rest, in 1970 and 71, were freaking out about this anti-establishment, specifically anti-business sentiment that Ralph Nader and the general public were buying into, that it's unfair, corporations are not to be trusted. All that what had begun in the New Deal had suddenly become, to their eyes, kind of extreme in the late 60s. And what are we going to do to stop this? Maybe this talk of revolution is for real. Maybe the socialist revolution is nigh, they thought in 1970 and 71. So Lewis Powell in Virginia, age 60, whatever he was talking to a neighbor about this and ranting over bourbon, no doubt. And the neighbor happened to be an official of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and said, Lewis, why don't we at the Chamber of Commerce commission you to write a memo explaining this and explaining your plan to stop this socialist left-wing Ho Chi Minh of America takeover of the American way of life and the destruction of free enterprise. Why? I sure will. And he did that and turned it in and again, and was a couple of months later nominated by Richard Nixon to be a Supreme Court justice. That is interesting, and that's why Lewis Powell is famous, of course, but I'm not postulating that, for instance, as part of any conspiracy.
No.
But, so this moderate guy was suddenly immoderately hysterical about what was going on in this late 60s way, but because he was this skilled lawyer and strategist and had been for 40 years, he laid out in this very skillful, lawyerly way, this is what we got to do. We got to create these think tanks to take over the intellectual life as much as we can. We got to change the discourse in the media. We've got to organize business people and CEOs to be effective, not just protecting their own company, but protecting and defending and asserting the importance of capitalism and profits. He just lays it out, and which was an extraordinary thing to do at that time, and certainly given that what happened bears a striking resemblance to what he laid out in the summer of 1971 is amazing. He also had done one of the things I don't really consider myself a real historian and doing primary research, but I did discover this very, very little known speech of his that preceded that memo, the Powell memo, as it's now called, that he'd given a year ago, which is even more hysterical about oh my God, the greening of America, it's crazy, they're going to take us down, we're going to be, he didn't quite say we're going to be put up against the wall and shot, but all but. There he had it, and almost, it was secret for a year, and then it was leaked to a newspaper columnist who talked about it, and it wasn't a big deal, but like, oh, look, this thing that Justice Powell wrote a year and a year and a half ago. But immediately, as soon as it became to that degree public, it became like this truly founding scriptural document for Charles Koch, for instance, and all of the Charles Kochs of the world, the libertarian and right-wing people and general CEOs were suddenly liberated by, oh, now we have a mission, we have a doctrine, we have a document, we have a plan, a battle plan. So that was the beginning. And then I didn't know either. And then as I just, there was so much I didn't know as I did the research about in so many different realms of how to think about how we should think or shouldn't think about antitrust enforcement and are monopolies good or bad and just all across the board, the way the conventional wisdom was pretty radically changed in America about fairness, basically, and about what the government should or shouldn't do in terms of making the economy fair for most Americans. And it was, and they did it, and they changed it quickly. I mean, another memo that I knew nothing about was this one that was commissioned by a different right-wing billionaire, Richard Mellon Scaife, in 1979 and was completed in 1980, that laid out even more extraordinarily, really, beat by beat, how the right, this same economic right, should try to have influence in and to whatever degree possible, take over the understandings of the law and the judiciary and jurisprudence in America. Well, and a year later, the Federalist Society is established and the rest is history. And it, so again, I'm not, as you know, a conspiracist or a conspiracy minded, but you look at the evidence and the history and it's hard not to see that there was this extraordinary, brilliant effort in many, many different places to bring about this change. Also, this thing called the Business Roundtable was founded right then in the early 70s as well. You know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was always the national business organization, but it consisted of thousands and thousands of companies, large and small, and was therefore everybody, all kinds of businesses belonged, so it had that power, but it was kind of ineffectual because what does GE have in common with the Dave's widget shop here?
Yeah.
So the CEOs of the biggest companies got together and said, no, we need just us, just the 200 CEOs of the biggest companies. And instead of just being some kind of public face of saying we believe in business, we need to get in there and fight the fight in Washington and lobby and threaten and to be organized capital. My phrase, not theirs.
And you've pointed out in the book, the big kind of crucial year, watershed year, is 1980, around the time that Reagan is going to come into office. He's going to be the affable face and the salesman, really, of this new concentration of business minds and fellow travelers from Milton Friedman to the Kochs to, you know, name the people you've heard of now because they've all came to fame and power since. But and it, the thing that really struck me reading your book was how important it was for them to do away with and ultimately crush the labor unions. How this was really to take away the bargaining power of the worker ends up being kind of the most important block in all of this, because once you've got that out of the way, you know, off to the races.
No, and I didn't, I certainly at the time didn't realize it. And of course, I write about the history of growing, mutual contempt between young people like me, new young liberals coming of age in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and labor unions and union members, and essentially the educated white collar cohort versus the unionized blue collar cohort, starting not over economic issues, of course, but over the war and the counterculture and all those late 60s issues. We saw it, of course, in 1968 at the Chicago Democratic Convention of Mayor Daley and his police beating up protesters. But there were other incidents like that, and that was the beginning of a big political fissure that we are still living with and dealing with, obviously, politically. And I wasn't anti-union, but I belonged to the Newspaper Guild at my first big journalism job at Time Magazine, but unions, whatever, they're old, they're racist, they're sexist, they were pro-war, unions. Yeah. So I call myself one of the liberal useful idiots, not this time to the communists, as that phrase was originally used, but to the capitalists, sort of allowing or at least looking the other way or shrugging about the crushing of the unions that took place very quickly and very successfully. The ground was softened in the 70s, but then as soon as Ronald Reagan became president, crushed, really, truly crushed overnight, one of the few labor unions, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, who had endorsed him for their presidency. And that really just gave the green light to big companies to crush unions, to replace strikers, and do the whole range of things that in that decade of the 1980s, I mean, the labor movement and the labor unions in the United States as a key player at the table of the economy was just undone.
This is Inside the Hive.
3, 2, 1. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED Politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hive.
You know, at this juncture, I'm thinking about when I came into the workforce. It's the mid-90s, at the dawn of the internet boom. And all my assumptions about economics, about the stock market, about money in general were received at that moment. Right. I hadn't done a lot of deep thinking about it in any way. And so I came into the world thinking stocks go up good, shareholder value. It was getting frothy. Everything was going crazy. And capitalism was taking on this like kind of cool. Right. And we were all a part of that. And you talk about useful idiots. We were all kind of indulging in it because it seemed like it was the post-Cold War inheritance was that we won the game. All boats are rising. How were we wrong?
Well, we were wrong because we ignored the fact that the system, in all kinds of ways, many and probably most of them, too tedious or an obscure and abstruse and to have paid much attention to, the system was rigged, was re-engineered through tax codes, through regulation, deregulation, lack of antitrust enforcement, companies deciding, no, we're not going to give fixed pensions anymore. What happened to the healthcare industry and the resulting unaffordability of healthcare, on and on and on and on. All of which happened from 1978 to 1998, but especially in the 80s. We ignored that because we were doing fine. Yeah. Basically, is the answer. I was doing fine. You were doing fine, and we were enjoying ourselves. And this just seemed like the new reality. I mean, and part of my reason for writing this book is because, you know, I'm old enough that I at least experienced up to the time I was 25, the old system. I saw, and now having done my research, I see that it was a different, fairer system, especially since the New Deal in the 30s, under which Americans were living. That was not only much fairer, much more economically equal, much more economically secure, but had become more so. And in 1976 had reached its top. In 1976, by the numbers and metrics, the United States was more economically equal than it had ever been. And hey, let's celebrate. No, let's twist all the dials so that it ceases to be so and starts becoming as economically unequal and insecure as it was a century ago.
Right. Well, and, you know, you and I were a part of a New York media world in which sort of sent up all these, like, power brokers who were getting super rich and living like pigs in the Hamptons and elsewhere. You know, we were both, like, on the margins of it and making fun of it. But, you know, even at the time, we sort of were like, wow, this is, where does it end? This is crazy. And suddenly you started to see also, you know, working class people too, driving giant SUVs, and then there was sudden credit was all over the place, and there was just this, you know, crazy ripening of the economy that was going on that turned out to be unsustainable.
Right.
And Democrats, and this is a really important thing you point out in the book, just became really, they were playing on the ball field of the GOP every time they got into power, right? If they had Congress or if they were in the White House, Clinton was a triangulator who basically, you know, he paid lip service to their business values.
And really accepted that social problems can only be solved by market-based solutions. That was key. I mean, basically, yes, Democrats and liberals on economics decided that they really didn't disagree with Republicans. I mean, they became essentially liberal Republicans after liberal Republicans ceased to exist on economics. There was no party of the left on economics. And then, of course, the other important things that Democrats were distinctly and consistently to the left on, more or less, of matters of race and culture and sexuality and the rest, feminism and women's rights and civil rights, that became the way in which they were distinct from Republicans, which, if you are a hypothetical white working class person and you look at the parties and go like, they're pretty much the same on economics. They don't give a fuck about me or the fact that my manufacturing job has either been automated or shipped to China or whatever. Or choose your legitimate reason to be an angry, person like that. And then you look, well, what else? Oh, how are they different? How they're different is they're not maybe the Republicans don't care about me really, but the Democrats really care about other people than me. Mm-hmm. So there you have there. That's where we are politically. You know, and meanwhile, my evil geniuses, the economic right, who really kept their eye on the ball, and always keep their eye on the ball. Let's let the rich get richer. Taxes, low taxes are everything. The power of big business to do what it wants is key and paramount, overrides everything else. But to get what we want and to be politically successful, we're going to have as our allies this rabble, these white working class people, these racists. And that started in the 1960s and hasn't stopped. And here we are with Donald Trump. That Faustian bargain maybe has now, it's come due, and maybe the evil geniuses will now, at least some of them, go to hell,
right.
Continuing my Faustian trope. But we'll see. But that's what happened. And then people like me, I won't drag you into this because you're of a different generation. But we were doing okay, and we did accept that. You know, the idea of regulating business and breaking up business and all the rest, all the whole New Deal menu and more of how the balance could be maintained between workers and citizens and the power of big business was broken, and we allowed it to be broken. Those of us who allowed it, who were doing okay financially, because we were doing okay financially, and you know, I don't want to go into the hyperbole of because the rich people were giving us, you know, their leftovers or their some crumbs, but effectively that
right.
is what happened,
right?
You know,
right. And I don't think that everybody was paying attention to how the middle was getting hollowed out as the efficiencies of big business began to work their magic with automation and outsourcing and the rest. But 2008, the economic collapse, I feel like we're only now finally coming to the final, you know, chapter of the ramifications of 2008. I've always noticed that it kind of like superpowered the conspiracy thinking that we've talked about. I mean, I remember when Alex Jones was on CNN, right, as a guy they would bring on to actually talk about things, and he's obviously a total nut job. And the one percenters and the Occupy Wall Street, and there's just this angry reaction, and it bifurcated into like Tea Party over here, Occupy over here, but it was always there simmering under the surface. And, you know, that's where Trump comes in to exploit that. And it's interesting that it was Trump and Bernie Sanders on the other side, in a way, talking about trade, right? So I guess my question is, he took advantage of that. And the irony being that he was the caricature of the go-go 80s when all of this big business stuff blew up. And then now he's coming in to say, I'm going to fix, undo, or otherwise assuage all the problems that I represented.
Well, no, one of the things he successfully ran on in 2016 was it takes a thief, effectively.
Right.
You know, I know how these people work. I own these politicians. I'll get rid of them. Which was, you know, in the ways that he is brilliant, that was a brilliant thing to do. But of course, he wasn't part of big business. Never was part of big business. He's a small businessman,
right,
who got big business, that is to say banks and Wall Street, to fund his vanities and follies for many decades. And to me, I mean, this is a bit of a digression, but Donald Trump's business success, I'm making quote marks, air quotes, is a collateral damage of the hideous growth of Wall Street and the financial industry and its recklessness and its the fact that they again and again and again we'll see how the truth of that once gosh, I do sound like Alex Jones, don't I? Once the Deutsche Bank situation is fully exposed. But the fact that these banks, these reputable banks and institutions were providing loans to this guy they had to know was an untrustworthy buffoon,
yeah,
is evidence for the degree of recklessness and self-dealing and all the rest that Wall Street had undergone in the 70s and 80s.
And one of his campaign ads in 2016 had Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman, in it. As an evil villain.
Correct. And yet, that's the other thing. I mean, Donald Trump ran. I mean, the Steve Bannon version of Donald Trump, which is to say, yeah, racist, xenophobe, bigot, all that. But yes, Medicare, we're going to keep your Medicare, keep your Social Security. It's going to be better than it ever was. We're going to spend trillions rebuilding the infrastructure. If he had governed like that, this unusual Republican who's not going by the normal Republican tenets, I believe that a lot of people on the left and liberals would have held their nose and say, yeah, not bad. And he'd have 65-70% approval rating now. I really believe that.
Yeah.
Instead, what he did, because he's an idiot, and because he understood that Republicans and elected Republicans are quislings, and that all they want, because you know the prime directive of the economic evil geniuses is keep taxes low, keep regulation off of business, keep taxes low, keep regulation That's off it. Of business. And so he gave him all that. Yeah. Oh, that's what you care about? Fine. Whatever.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Right. Well, another subplot to your book is the cultural effect of all this redistribution of wealth to the top and the politicization of it, the political economy of it, which was that whereas there, you call the 70s, the 60s and 70s, peak new. Right. This is when we had all gotten used to a level of just continual change, which is part of the American kind of impulse to reinvent constantly. Well, that began to slow down. And you noticed it from looking at a photograph of some people from the 80s recently, maybe in the last 10 years. Tell me about that.
Well, and in fact, I noticed it and then wrote a piece about it for Vanity Fair magazine that appeared in 2011.
We'll link to that.
Yeah. No, I happened to see this picture in 2007, I think, in the New York Times. It was a profile of Steve Rubell and his partner, who had become who started, of course, Studio 54 and had become big hotel impresarios. Anyway, it was a picture of them and their staff at Morgan's, which was this sort of first fancy big boutique hotel in 1986, I think it started more or less. Anyway, all these waiters and attendants and bell people, a big crowd of attractive young people standing outside with their bosses on a Manhattan street. And it was 20 years old, this picture. That's an old picture. Almost nothing about any of them, the way they were dressed, looked, groomed, looked anything other than 2007. And I thought, that's weird, isn't it? Because, of course, for my whole lifetime, and then before my lifetime, things changed every decade pretty significantly. I mean, cars looked different. The way people did their hair and groomed themselves, dressed looked different, and design looked different. And each decade had its own character. And I thought, well, that's weird. I began trying to figure out. I just became kind of obsessed with this. And why did that happen? When I wrote about it, wrote an essay about it, I didn't really connect it very much to what had happened economically, what was happening economically at the same time. And again, I'm not such a conspiracist that I think the evil geniuses are genius enough or powerful enough to have contrived to stop that kind of cultural change.
Reverse engineer culture or something.
No. However, I do think they were synergistic. And I do think that the fact that things after the 80s really stopped, after we spent a decade or two just wallowing in nostalgia, which was the degree of the wallow was new for America. This stasis happened, and I really do think that it has served the interests of the people who don't want big political and economic change to make people think, without even thinking that they're thinking, but just, oh, no, things don't really change. It's the same. Listen to the same music. You know, this new singer is not so different than the same, than a singer that was 20 years ago. And what's that? What has happened so radically new since hip hop, let's say, yeah, as an example in pop culture, mm-hmm, of a truly new thing in the 70s and 80s? And then, but what's been as big as that? And you can go through the whole realm of culture and think like, like, that's weird. And again, I mean, while I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I am a seeker of unified theories of existence.
A Zeitgeistian.
I do in Evil Geniuses connect nostalgia and this strange cultural stasis to the bigger economic and political changes that happen. And it really is unprecedented. I mean, America was about the new. Modern life is about this constant novelty in all realms. And instead, the novelty of the last several decades has been in the digital realm, sure, but very little else in the culture.
Right. And it almost serves as like a funhouse mirror of everything that we already had, like a giant archive of constantly coming at us.
This is Inside the Hive.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
You and I have talked about this in the past, but, you know, we talk about the 20th century being this kind of anomaly of a monoculture in which you had a narrow band of media through which everything was coming. And a lot of us experienced all these newnesses you're talking about through that, you know, through the distribution of sound and image and news and information and politics and the rest. And as the internet came along and fractured that, you know, you talk... And I made this parallel reading your book. I was thinking, you're saying that these, right-wing forces, they tried to de-engineer the New Deal and take us back to before the Depression, you know? And in doing so, ended up exposing us to similar problems, by the way. But also back to a pre-media time when you have a fragmented media and it's more like the pamphleteering late 19th century now than it was 20 years ago. Like, we reversed that too.
That's a good point. And I think in Fantasy Island I wrote about that media part of it, which is so true. I mean, when we think often, I talk about pathological nostalgia, which is, you know, we're all nostalgic for something, but America and certain kinds of Americans have become pathologically nostalgic, and that drives a lot of our politics. But and when we talk about that, it's often, oh, they all want it to be the 50s again. Oh, they want it to be the 50s again. No, the 50s were pretty good, except for the racist, sexist, misogynist part of it. I mean, economically, the 50s were good. My economic evil geniuses, want it to be, as you say, like, before there was a federal government, before there was income taxes, before there was a public health system. And indeed, before there was
a mainstream, instance, media.
Mainstream media. I mean, the newspapers, big newspapers that, you know, dominated American media for a century, were the result of business constraints, which is to say, to sell as many newspapers as you could in a given city, you couldn't be left wing or right wing. You had to kind of have a big tent and appeal to everybody. And yes, with cable television and talk radio and unregulated talk radio and certainly the internet, that business constraint was no longer there. The idea of the good side of mainstreamness, which is that mostly just untrue craziness could be kept out of the the mainstream, that started disappearing, and here we are. I mean, no question, there were all kinds of bad things about the mainstream and dissident opinion being stigmatized and kept out of it. No question. But we didn't have QAnon, right. For instance, back when you know, there were only three networks and two news magazines and a couple of national newspapers.
Right. Well, and I thought a lot about you know, the Ross Douthat's recent book makes a kind of case that we've reached a decadence.
Yes.
From our success.
Yes.
And
in which he quotes Fantasyland at length.
And that makes perfect sense to me, because this is all of a piece. And one of the things I love about your writing and your books is that you articulate things that I have been floating around in my mind as I look out. And I'm like, yeah, why is the culture seeming to be a little bit static? Why, you know, I'm a big music fan. Like, why is music not as impactful as it once seemed? It doesn't have the centrality to the culture. Well, the culture is no longer central. It's been fragmented. And it sort of reflected the economic thing as well, in that everybody now has the option to go into their little silo, and then QAnon being one of the wacky ones, right? I don't know what I'm saying with this, but basically,
I'm glad it wasn't just me.
Yeah, yeah, it was
getting to some place like that.
Yeah, but you know, the decadence that we've been and Trump could not be a more glaring symptom of that decadence.
Well, and when you say decadent, I think of capitalism as it's practiced in the United States, because I give me a free market like the Nordic countries and I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good.
I mean, and by the way, they are free market systems. They're not socialist countries. They're free market countries.
Right. And you make that point in the book. And
with great social democracies and the systems. But the term that so many people have been using the last couple of decades and more lately is late capitalism, which of course implies that it's about to die. which I think is
there's a
sort of wishful thing, but it is definitely a decadent capitalism in America, no question. I think that's to me a more precise and true phrase, and doesn't suggest that it's going to collapse in some miraculous way because it's right. late. I mean, I've been hearing the phrase late capitalism for a long time, you know, and you're kind of, it's like waiting for the end of the world when some prophet says the world is about to end.
Right.
But, you know, it is absolutely a decadent. And of course, and decadent in specifically in the story of evil geniuses, that we have become this kind of not North American, but traditionally Latin American kind of oligarchy, where only the rich are getting richer and building real and figurative gates to keep all the peasants away.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think during this pandemic, you know, when we saw Geffen on his boat out in the Caribbean or wherever he was, you know, people immediately were struck by that as a sign and symptom of, the separation of the haves and have nots. One thing to point out, let's just get into the slivers of hope section of our conversation here. You know, you point out a really interesting thing in the book, that 25 years ago, there was a poll taken. They asked people, do you want the government to do more for people or less? And 62% at the time said, no, we don't. It's like, we don't want more government. We want less. It was a part of the Republican.
And the choice was more government to do more or let people and businesses take care of their own problems.
Exactly. And now it's flipped more or less. 58% would like to see the government do more. And you start to explore whether we're at an inflection point. Certainly it looks like it. I mean, the Bernie Sanders and the Elizabeth Warrens of the world and the Andrew Yangs have been on national stages delivering messages that you would never have heard 10 years ago.
Correct.
And that's a radical thing. And you know, that's what Trump's will exploit, the fear of that. But it may be that our options are narrowing at this crossroads between more of this, kind of autocratic demagoguery and actually solving the problem.
Well, and I mean, the hopeful possibilities that coming out of the pandemic and its economic consequences is sane people, sensible, reasonable people will look and say, no, we really do need an effective government to deal with not only huge one-off challenges like this, but both economically and in a public health sense. But no, we really do need government. We're not all on our own. Business can't do it by itself. To me, it's both a case study, the reaction of the Trump administration and the right from the get-go of, no, open up right away. Mm-hmm. We'll deal with it. Keep the stock market going. Yeah. And down the line, they just played from their playbook of how they've been privileging and prioritizing stock prices and corporate profits above all else. I mean, these last 6 months have been just an extraordinary case study in that. Now, I hope that will be clear to more people than ever that, wait a minute, they really, not only do they not, as the survey question often has it, care about people like me, they really care only about their narrow economic interests, period, end of story. So, and the question is can the various other fissures, social, cultural fissures in America that all kinds of people, especially Donald Trump and the Republican Party, exploit politically, can those be put in abeyance enough to create a good working majority of people who can be activated politically in their own economic interests?
Right.
And the economic interests, by the way, of America, of the economy. Again, racism and misogyny and patriarchy aside, the 50s and 60s and 70s are a model. If we had that economy now, the growth, the fair, the equitable arrangements of how the wealth was shared, my God, we were as equal back in the day as some of the Scandinavian countries are now. It would be great, and so it's not really radical. And we had these enormously higher tax rates on the rich. Didn't seem to hurt growth, did it?
No, it didn't. And two things you point out in the book that are, I would say, interesting tea leaves to read is one is that the Business Roundtable, which is one of these big business groups that's part of the cabal, right, was invented at the dawn of the cabal, really, kind of came out in 2019 kind of advocating for more responsibility to the workers. Like, uh-oh, maybe this isn't going to go so hot for us if we keep going in this direction where we haven't corrected in any way. And you point out that Financial Times this last spring said about the pandemic, virus lays bare the frailty of the social contract. Now, this is the first election I can remember in which I've never heard it before come up, the social contract. We're rethinking the entire thing. So tell me a minute about, you talk in here about the Alaska model, because it's an interesting thing because it gets to a lot of other conversations. But
yeah, well, I mean, Andrew Yang, during his perfectly great presidential run, he was probably not ever going to be nominated for the presidency, but to get the conversation going, not only about universal basic income, but about how AI and automation are going to continue eliminating jobs. They just are. And this is different than the other industrial revolutions. And there are not going to be enough jobs that it makes economic sense for people to do, period, end of story. How are we going to deal with that? So, the fact that that was not regarded as crazy and that, like, people, Republicans as well as Democrats in polling said, yeah, universal basic income, some kind might be necessary. Fantastic that is now legitimately on the table. So Alaska, 50 years ago, they had this gigantic oil strike in the North Slope of Alaska, and all the oil companies wanted to drill there. And Alaska said, okay, you can do that, but we're going to charge you these, we're going to get a share of these gigantic billions of dollars of oil revenues you're going to get. And the then Republican governor, since Alaska has almost exclusively Republican governors and is a very Republican state, decided, on the advice of this libertarian socialist economist who worked at the University of Alaska, we're going to give that money directly. We're going to give a large chunk of that money, guaranteed, amend the constitution of the state to give a portion of that money to every individual in Alaska, man, woman, and child, no matter what, no strings attached. So we have had, Alaska has had a universal basic income. Now it's small. It's not of the, it can't let you live, but it's thousands of dollars, often several thousands of dollars, at least $1,000 or $2 a year to every man, woman, and child. So if you've got a family, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 every year. Yeah, that obviously makes a huge difference in people's lives. So we've had this incredibly successful experiment. Now, ironically and unfortunately, it's based on fossil fuels, and that's a whole other conversation. But the principle is the thing, is that there is social wealth. Alaskans decided, hey, this is our oil. We should all each benefit from this rather than have it just vaguely go away to whoever.
And you point out in there that there was an uptick in women entering the workforce because they could afford childcare.
Yes, and there are also studies about childhood health that got better and all kinds of things. And by the way, it's unclear exactly to what degree the Alaska Permanent Fund is responsible. This thing that has given every Alaskan thousands of dollars a year every year, no matter what, for the last several decades, is responsible. But back then, when it started, Alaska was one of the most economically unequal states in the union. Today, it is one of the top one or two least unequal states in the union. So, but really, I think it's important that it here is this conservative, Western, ultra entrepreneurial, individualistic state that has had and loves and would not ever give up this social welfare payment.
Yeah.
And understands that there is such a thing as social wealth, in this case oil, but it could also be allowing polluters, charging polluters to pollute, or charging internet companies for all the work that the government did inventing the internet, or any number of things.
Well, social wealth is a thing. Those were really interesting observations to me. I hadn't heard them before, but and you, God bless you, you read Hillary Clinton's memoir. There was a little thing in there where she said she considered, what if we, made the fossil fuel industry pay based on how much CO2 emissions they have and then give it away to people?
No, she specifically said, basically copying Alaska on a national scale in some way. And she wasn't entirely clear whether it would just be fossil fuel or where the funding would come. But yes, and she and Bill and her campaign decided, no, we couldn't make the numbers work. And so maybe that's too bad. Maybe I would have won. It is beginning to think, the outside the box in these radical ways that in this case isn't so radical because, as Justice Brandeis said, in the laboratory of democracy, we've had one of our states prove that in this way, in this, it has worked just fine.
Yeah. And just as an aside, the other thing you pointed out that was interesting is that how much the government is involved in the invention of things like the internet and receives no return on that investment. And you liken it to, we built a highway and then we let a bunch of young college kids put tolls up on it and collect all the money and we don't get any of it. So I'm thinking now we're talking about this inflection point and the importance of this election. I just want to go on record saying your book is a great primer for thinking about what the meaning of this election is. Look at the big view. Let's go to 20,000 feet. Let's look at the last 50 to 75 years and think about where we want to go from here. We're so caught up in the daily news cycle and we're boring into every little Twitter war and dumb thing that Trump says. But let's back up a minute here and think about which direction we want to go. Apocalypse and demagoguery or reinvent the country and go somewhere optimistic and sunny, okay?
Yeah.
And, a thing that I hope that Joe Biden will bring up in this election is something you point out. You just mentioned it in passing, but I just know that it's going to be a thing. which is that all these people are out of work right now. And when the corporations go back, they're going to use this as an excuse to reduce their workforce, not hire more people. They're going to see how efficient everything was without all these workers, and there's going to be even more unemployment and more people without jobs and without security. A floor has to come under these people. We've got to reinvent the floor, right? A new deal has to be created.
And absolutely right. And when I started writing this book, just after I'd finished Fantasyland almost 4 years ago, I wanted it, my plan, and bless them, Random House agreed that, okay, I'll turn it in the beginning of 2020 and we'll get it out quickly so it can be around, not so it can be part of the election conversation. I think you're exactly right. I think it is, this is an inflection point moment. And Andy Grove, the great founder of Intel, who popularized the idea of the inflection point in for businesses and groups and societies and organizations, made the point that inflection point can go take you to the stars or down to the bottom. Right. And that's where we are. I really do, because I'm not without hope. If we re-engineer our re-engineered, badly re-engineered economic system, the sky's the limit with AI, with automation, with all of it. And to their credit, I mean, people like Mark Zuckerberg, who, not to defend him or Facebook, except he and other Silicon Valley people, at least are honest enough to have made the leap and understand where technology is going in terms of work and the larger economy to say, yeah, something like universal basic income is going to be necessary. The old way of just give business whatever it wants and screw the people who the losers, that just isn't going to work. And so at least he and they, in their engineer Spockian way, understand where this is going, and that a solution that will look radical is going to be necessary.
Right. And so we have Joe Biden, who's sort of like, you can put the radical juice into the old Coke bottle and,
He's Captain Kirk.
He's okay? Captain Kirk. That's right.
I don't know. Yeah. Well, I mean, let's cross our fingers and hope, A, that he's elected. I believe that he is enough of a, you know, he wants to do right. He wants things. He wants people to be happy. He does. I mean, he is, God knows, beset by nostalgia to an extreme about how better life was in Scranton when he was a kid and all that. But it was. So he also is obviously a consummate politician, and if people, and specifically Democrats, are pushing him to the left, he's not going to resist.
Right.
You know, he is not. So I'm hopeful about what could happen in his administration and beyond. But it really, to your point about, you know, short term, like what happened today? What did Trump say today? Or what's going to happen in the election in November? We really have to think, we have to obviously toggle between thinking short term, win this election, and long term, well, for what purpose other than to prevent a fascist autocracy? Yes, that's important, but truly, if beyond that and beyond not getting unapologetic racists out of the White House and all the obvious things about Donald Trump, let's not think, as I'm afraid Joe Biden has, that it's just about Trump. That there hasn't been a big problem of which I, anybody who calls themselves a Democrat, mostly have been part of not understanding how what happened to the economy and how things went bad didn't just happen. It was part of a set of plans and a very long game, and you know, the things I talked about in Fantasyland of the magical thinking and conspiracy theories and delusions and all that, which has been part of the American character forever, and that's gotten out of hand and it's a big problem. And it, in a way, it can't be fixed. It can be stopped. We can fight and need to fight to sort of say no more. Take QAnon off Twitter, for instance. But this is fixable. This was this other way 40 and 50 years ago, and then was changed, and it can be changed back as long as we have a democracy, as long as we have politics. This can be fixed. So I'm hopeful in a way that I really wasn't once I came to the conclusions I came to about Fantasyland. But in terms of the evil geniuses and what they have wrought, well, they wrought it. And indeed, as you know from reading the book, I think we who are not of that ilk can look at what they did and see and copy it to some degree and see what a long game they played and how they kept their eye on the important ball and all these other things that, like, man, they did it. And if we want to turn the United States of America into a decent, fair social democracy, well, you know, there's a lot to learn from the history of how they did it the other way.
And that playbook in reverse, which you can read, is called Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. It's going to take a long time for me to digest it. It's like incredibly filled with amazing facts that just sort of gobsmacked me and kept me rolling along, and I really enjoyed it. And I think it's an important book. Kurt Anderson, thanks for coming on to Inside the Hive. It's been a pleasure to be outdoors, and our third party was the cricket.
And the breezes.
And the breezes.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. And that's our show this week. Thanks to my guest, Kurt Anderson. And of course, Emily Jane Fox, my lovely co-host. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive. You can find those on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. And thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, especially our producer, Bob Tabador. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors. Please support them the way they support this podcast. And we'll see you next week.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS, just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.